Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, one and all, and welcome to Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. I'm your host, Joe Haddo, and as ever, thanks for joining us. You are all very welcome. As always, I'm joined by two fabulous authors who'll be going head-to-head in a war of the words a little later on in our Book Off. They are the internationally best-selling author and screenwriter who is here to tell us about her latest novel, The Pull of the Stars, Emma Donoghue. Hello and welcome to you.
Hi, nice to be on Book Off.
It's great to have you, Emma. And also joining us, a poet, author and short story writer who's just published his fourth novel, The Innocents. Michael Crummy, hello.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Thank you both for joining us. It's lovely to be chatting. And in Canadian terms, are you sort of neighbours?
Definitely friends, but not next door neighbours, no. I think we're half an hour apart, aren't we, in time zone terms?
Well, hour and a half, I think, Emma.
Oh, you're right. So, sorry, I was concentrating on the half an hour because it's such a novelty. I completely forgot about the going on hour as well.
Yeah.
That's it.
No, Newfoundland, I'm actually closer to Ireland here in Newfoundland than I am to Toronto, for example. So.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah.
You see, a country that has different time zones and also can be closer to Ireland than it can to another place in its own country is amazing, isn't it?
I'm jealous now. I want to be closer to Ireland.
Well, you're welcome here anytime.
At least I wouldn't have to be quarantined there.
That's right.
You two know each other from doing events and perhaps you've sort of been in the same touring circles in Canada. Is that how you first met?
Well, actually, no, we've met years and years ago. We actually watched the Oscars together about, it's 25 years ago now or more, I'd say. And I was at a conference that, Emma, was a friend of yours had organized on the Hand?
That's right. They had an Oscar party every year.
Yeah. And, but then we barely crossed paths again until this year, really, which is strange because it's such a small world here in Canada, the publishing world, but we shared a cab to the airport in Vancouver last fall, and we've done a couple of
events.
And
I was really afraid I had a terrible cold and you were going on to prize galas and I had a dreadful fear that I'd spread my germs on you. This was all pre-COVID.
Right.
I was just afraid I'd given you an ordinary bad cold.
But it all worked out.
Which is the one thing you don't want as an author before you're about to embark on a tour, is it?
Yeah, it's kind of endemic to that whole touring thing. Is somebody comes down with something and it just gets passed around. So,
so for any new listeners that are joining us, Michael and Emma will be going head to head a little later on, pitching us a book that they love and that they think we should all read. But they only have 3 minutes in which to convince us. So we'll come to that a bit later. Firstly, I want to talk about both of your latest novels. I've got them sat here in front of me, and I have to say, side by side, they look magnificent because, wow, these front covers are gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. I'm talking about The Pull of the Stars, Emma, and The Innocents, Michael. Emma, if I could come to you first, this book was published earlier in the year, and although it's set in 1918, part of the story has a strange resemblance to the current pandemic, doesn't it?
And that's pure fluke, because I finished the novel completely the beginning of March this year, having, you know, sold it last year, and it was meant to be published in 2021. And I delivered it, and honestly, no similarity to today had occurred to me. I was just so absorbed in the book. And then my publisher said, it's about a pandemic. Do you think maybe we should bring it out this year? So I felt a little sheepish. It's not like I was trying to comment about the events of today, and I didn't do anything to change it. It just has a lot of similarities, because not only is any story of a pandemic in a sort of busy modern world going to sound like any other, but also my novel focuses on the inner city Dublin slums, where the patients of my nurse protagonist, Julia Power, come from. And of course, you know, she's drawing all sorts of conclusions from looking at their lives and seeing that they were beaten down long before the flu ever caught them. You know, that pandemics are not equalizing. Pandemics hit hard those who we've chosen to keep down already. So all those questions of social justice and healthcare came up in the book. And then reading headlines the last few months, it's all felt so eerily reminiscent of that pandemic to me.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it, that it can be almost 100 years apart, as in the story that you're writing and where we are now, and yet there's so much resonance. And do you think the decision to sort of publish it this year rather than wait till next was because of that, or just because we literally don't know where we're going to be in the world in 2021, so it was sort of better to get this story out now?
Well, back in March, they were not certain people would be buying any books at all in July. I remember my British publisher saying, "We're not sure we can get it printed in time." You know, literally, will the printers be open? So I think they just felt it would be part of the conversation this year, whereas certainly I feel by next year, people will be so entirely sick of pandemic stories that nobody would touch it. So I think it made sense, but it was startling to me because, you know, in literary fiction, we're used to our books taking at least a year, sometimes two. So it was amazing to me that they were able to bring it out this fast. And I certainly wasn't expecting to be, you know, virtual touring from home, though it does have some advantages over the traveling kind. You know, it's far less physically arduous and you get to reach people all over the world.
In fact, just before we started recording, Michael and I were saying just that, you know, although it's lovely to see your readers, you know, and be able to meet them and sign books and things, actually doing the virtual stuff means that anyone in the world can join you. So that's quite nice.
Yeah, I've had readers write to me and say, "I never usually get to these events, and now I can, you know, they're supplied to me online for free. It's amazing."
Yeah. So there are some positives.
Yeah, I wonder how much of this will continue on, actually, after we get back to something like normal life. I think some of this will continue.
And yeah, because people have got used to it and realise they quite enjoy it as well.
For instance, online theatre, I would have thought that was a contradiction in terms, but I've so enjoyed watching some plays online filmed really well. So I think that'll definitely be a new cultural habit for me, as well as my rushing off to see live theatre as soon as I can.
Yes. Well, of course, something like, you know, NT Live, which is the cinema broadcasts of the National Theatre, in London, they were very popular anyway, but now having sort of transferred them to the small screen so that people can enjoy theatre from their homes, it's been a real success. And I think so many of us, you know, like you, Emma, and me, who love theatre, have been really grateful for it.
Yeah, NT Live was my gateway drug, actually. I watched their production of One Man, Two Governors back in mid-March, and it was the first time I relaxed and laughed since COVID.
Yes, we all need something like that, don't we? Michael, if I could ask you about The Innocents, which is your latest novel, which I think was inspired by a story you found in a local archive, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It was just about everything I've ever written has been historical to one extent or another. So I spend a lot of time at the provincial archives at the rooms here in St. John's. And I usually go in to research something specific, but I take some time just to poke around because there are tens of thousands of fragments of amazing stories in there. And I almost always find something I want to use. And it's almost 10 years ago now, I guess, I was in researching a particular project, and I happened on, I can't remember, honestly, if it was in a newspaper or a journal, but it was an account of a clergyman traveling around Newfoundland. So this was way back. This would be a couple of hundred years ago when most Newfoundland communities were too small to have their own church. So the clergy traveled. And this clergyman in the course of those travels happened on an orphan brother and sister, a young brother and sister in an isolated cove on the northern coast of Newfoundland. And he quickly sussed out that the sister was pregnant. And automatically assumed, and I'm sure he was right to do this, that the brother was the father of that child. And that was really it. There was no other information about how long they had been orphaned for, what happened to them afterwards. But I knew as soon as I read that there was a novel in those circumstances. That was my first thought. And my second thought, which was way stronger than my first, was I'm not touching that with a 10-foot pole. I don't want anything to do with that. And I didn't make a note of it. I couldn't find that account again if my life depended on it. And I proceeded to try and forget it. And those youngsters never quite left me. And I was haunted by the situation they found themselves in, which was to be left alone before those changes come over them as they move into adolescence, and then to have to muddle forward with no resources and no one to turn to and try to understand how they were supposed to be in the world as the different people they were becoming. So I avoided it for years and years and years and years, but finally a couple of years ago sat down and I took a shot at trying to tell a story like theirs.
And have done brilliantly, it has to be said. We'll talk about the plot of that book in just a moment. Emma, I'm interested if there was a similar sort of archive or story that you had read that gave you the inspiration for your story in The Pull of the Stars.
No, I wish I could claim that, but it started with an article in The Economist magazine, you know. So often people think novelists are extraordinarily original in their researchers, and so often we're drawing on the work of other historians or of journalists. You know, it's a continuous feedback loop, all of us who write and publish in any form. So I'm deeply grateful to that anonymous journalist, because The Economist doesn't even use bylines. No, I read an article about the anniversary, the centenary of the flu pandemic. And of course, I'd known about the flu pandemic, but never paid it any really close attention. And I just was haunted by the atmosphere, the idea of this really busy modern world suddenly kind of grinding to a halt, because people were so afraid of this flu that could kill you literally in a matter of hours, or slowly over many weeks, or you could have a really mild case, or you could have just some mystery symptom like your sense of smell going. So when I did the initial research on my phone, because I'd accidentally left my computer at home and I was away for the weekend at a literary festival without my computer. So on my phone, I speed read everything I could find about the great flu. And what jumped out at me was a tiny little fact that women in very late pregnancy or just after birth were particularly liable to catch it and to have horrible side effects. And I found myself thinking, where did they put them? And I still haven't answered this question. I found no reference to special maternity quarantine wards, but there must have been somewhere that you would put a woman to give birth without infecting other birthing women with the flu. So I imagined a little, you know, makeshift three-person ward. And then I thought, you would have one nurse in charge of that ward, and who would she be? So the whole thing began with that question.
Right. And the book is set over just a few days, which I think gives it a real sort of intensity as well. Was that your intention?
Absolutely. 3 days, and it's set over Halloween, which is a slightly, you know, dark and carnivalesque atmosphere anyway.
Yes.
And it's set in the last month of the war. And it was such an interesting time. They were just about to give the vote to women over 30 for the first time, women of property. And Ireland was going through havoc those years as well. So that's one reason I set it in Ireland, when really I could have set it anywhere. But Ireland, you know, was moving in just a couple of years from most people being loyal to the king to most people saying, actually, we're going to vote Sinn Féin. We want our own government. So as we've seen with, say, the Black Lives Matter protests, I think times of upheaval and fear and even pandemic can lead to massive social change, because it sort of presses a reset button and gives everyone a chance to think, what society is it that we want to get up and running again?
Yeah. Do you think that there will be a sort of, slew is the wrong word, but do you think there will be some sort of COVID novels published after this pandemic?
Well, there'd certainly be some, yes. And memoirs, I would imagine. I think probably people will have a real appetite for, you know, accounts of the trenches War, you know, so just after you see after something like World War One, I think there will be a lot of, you know, doctors and nurses and so on talking about what it was like to go through the grueling, not just physical and mental, but ethical ringer of having to make those decisions. You know, already I've been gripped by articles from Italy about doctors deciding who to give the ventilators to.
Gosh, yeah, that's I think there's more stories like that to come. You're certainly right. Michael, the book is an exploration of the bond between siblings, as you've already alluded to. Having siblings, although they're all of the same sex, did it help sort of get into the mindset of that sibling bond for you for writing it?
Well, I guess to a certain extent, but the experience that those children have in the novel is so far outside my own experience that it's... It felt like I was entering a world completely unlike my own in many ways. And I have to admit, I'm happy I don't have a sister because a couple of people have come up to me and asked me directly, do I have a sister? And I've said no. And they said, good, because I've just read your book. So I'm glad not to have that that comparison at all. But I think... What I wanted, the only other bit of information in that account from the clergyman that I didn't mention was that being a clergyman, of course, he went after those youngsters and started telling them what an awful thing they had done and how sinful it was. And the brother eventually drove the clergyman away with a rifle. And I knew when I started writing this book that what I wanted to do was to write a book that did the exact opposite of what the clergyman did. I wanted to write a book that at the end of it, a reader would come away feeling no sense of judgment, but some sense of how difficult the circumstances they found themselves in were and how reasonable the decisions and choices they made were, even when they were not good for them. So for me, the book I decided was going to be a love story. And it's a novel about two children left in unbelievably difficult circumstances and what enables them to survive those circumstances. The reason they get through it, the reason they get up every day and go through this incredible slog that survival at the turn of the 18th century was in Newfoundland, was because of their love for the other person and their sense that they want the other person to survive and they're willing to do anything to make that happen.
Because, yeah, it is a story of survival, but it is also ultimately a story of love, isn't it? And that bond.
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason I didn't want to write this book to start with was because I didn't want to write a book about incest. And this is not a book about it. That's one of the threads that finds its way into the story of these two youngsters. But it's only one of many threads. And it's about their relationship in totality, which is so many other things. And so many other things in their relationship are far more important than that one thread.
Can you tell us what an outport is?
Well, I don't know where the term came from, but an outport is any community in Newfoundland that is not the capital city of St. John's. So it's...
Okay.
St. John's is town. So if you're going to town, you're going to St. John's. And every other community is an outport, so a port out from the capital city. So that's an outport is just a fishing community that isn't the capital.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, okay. I'm fascinated by Canada. I've never been, but it's on that big old list of places I must go. And I think one of the reasons I haven't been is because I feel I need to have, you know, 3 or 4 weeks to go and explore it properly. And as I have two authors who now live in Canada, I just wondered if you found it, if you had sort of great inspiration from it as a place, but also if you had specific places that you liked to go to write. Emma, you obviously moved to Canada as opposed to being born there. So let's start with you. Do you feel that it gives you that inspiration and that you're able to, you know, get really creative there?
It's funny. For me, the part of Canada I've moved to, London, Ontario, it's a very pleasant city. I don't find it particularly inspiring. I haven't tended to set things here. But Canada as a whole, I feel, has given me permission. You might contest this, but I feel Canadian identity compared with, say, Irish identity is very broad and encompassing and multicultural. And it's made of bits, you know, like Newfoundland only joined in the middle of the 20th century, for instance. So we're an assemblage. So there's no incredibly strong unified sense of what it is to be Canadian. And for newcomers or blow-ins like myself, that means there's room for us in the culture. And also I found because it's a, I don't want to over-idealize it here, but compared with Ireland, it felt like such a progressive society. And particularly, you know, if you're in a same-sex relationship with kids, you know, you want to be able to raise those kids without feeling that pressure of, say, Catholic conservatism coming in on you. So for me, Canada is a place where I've been able to get on with my life and get on with my writing with none of that sense of, you know, a lid pressing down on my mind. So I'd say it's been hugely permissive for me, hugely encouraging.
And Michael, you were born there, weren't you? You were born in...
I was born in Newfoundland, yeah. Yeah, so I lived in Ontario for about 13 years. Most Newfoundlanders do leave for some portion of their life, but there's a really strong pull back to home. So I've been home now for about 20 years. And Newfoundland is a place apart. And I love that notion that Emma just mentioned of Canada as an assemblage. I think that's absolutely true. And Newfoundland is the most recent part of that assemblage. And it's a world unto itself in many ways. You know, it was because it's an island in the middle of the North Atlantic, it's culturally and linguistically and genetically unlike anywhere else in the world. And I've spent my entire life writing about it in an attempt to get that N factor, as a local writer calls it, the Newfoundland factor, down on paper. Because there is something different about the people here. There's something about the way people's dependence on the natural world and the absolutely vicious and unpredictable nature of that natural world has created a particular character. And that's really what I've always been interested in trying to write about.
Yeah, I just think it's so interesting. And hearing you talk about where you live and, you know, looking at into outports and just the real geography of what Canada can offer, but in particular Newfoundland, it just feels like the sort of place one would want to go if, you know, to write. It's almost like that's where you'd want to go and sit for a few weeks and immerse yourself and, you know, write that novel.
Yeah, but there's lots of isolated spots, so there's lots of quiet and privacy if that's what you want, and the landscape is spectacular and often terrifying. So there's plenty of inspiration in all sorts of ways here.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Well, it's time for the book off now. And as I said, this is where each of you is going to tell us about a book that you love and that you think we should all read. You're going to get 3 minutes each to do so. And you don't have to use those 3 minutes if you don't want to. But if you go over the three, I am going to be cutting you down in your prime, either via the bicycle horn or the school bell. Before we get to those two books, I've been enjoying asking my guests what they've been reading recently and if anything sort of stood out some authors have been in the throes of, you know, writing, so actually what they've been reading is research materials. But it's just interesting to know what's been on the to-be-read pile over the last couple of months. So, Emma, have you read anything lately that you've really enjoyed?
Sure. I wouldn't have read it except that I still read aloud to my 13-year-old. I'm amazed she lets me. So we've been reading the series by Scott Westerfeld, young adult dystopian series, The Pretties, Specials, The Extras, The Uglies, riveting stuff and full of really interesting social commentary on our world. And I would never have read it because it's, you know, it's branded YA. So it's great to read with somebody else sometimes because you're pulled outside your usual habits.
Mm. Although I have to say, I am a huge YA fan in general, obviously not just because it's YA means that it's great, but I love delving into, you know, some of the YA that's out there because it's so imaginative and it really sort of takes you into a different world. There's some really great stuff, and I'm sure now that you've discovered these books, you know, you might find others along the way.
Yeah, and The Hunger Games was another sort of breakthrough moment for me because I realised actually this has kind of long roots in myth and legend and so on. And sometimes you can be, you know, misled by the kind of very modern surface of these books and not realise that, you know, they have very deep roots.
Absolutely, yeah. And what about you, Michael? Have you been reading recently?
I've actually been reading a lot of poetry recently, which is something I did a lot of earlier in my life and did more sporadically as I've gotten older. But there's something about the COVID lockdown that poetry seems to speak to somehow. And in particular, I've been reading Thomas Tranströmer, the Swedish poet, who I read years ago and liked, but wasn't really taken with. But just recently, His stuff just, there's a brilliant simplicity to his stuff and a depth to it and a loneliness to it as well. It's about the sort of the wonder of human consciousness in the world, but the loneliness of human consciousness in the world as well. And that seems perfect for the moment that most of us are living through, it seems.
Has it been a time to write poetry as well? Because I know that you've written before.
Yeah, I have been sort of muddling away at it. And that, again, that feels like the time, it feels like the right form for the moment or for my own personal moment. So I've really been grateful to have that to turn to.
Well, let's get to the book off then and find out, first of all, which books you are putting forward. So Emma, which book are you putting up for the book off today?
I'm going to go for Hanya Yanagihara's book, A Little Life.
Oh, A Little Life, but not a little book. Fantastic. And Michael, what are you putting forward?
I'm going with Herman Melville's Moby Dick.
Not messing about.
No. I like a challenge.
So we need to decide who goes first and who goes second. Emma, I'll let you make that decision. Would you like to go first and get it over with, or do you want to see what
you're
up
against?
Yeah, I'm
going to go get it over with, because if Michael is incredibly eloquent about Melville for 3 minutes, I'm just going to be crushed. I'm going to pretend that my software is glitching. This is what my 13-year-old does. If she's asked an awkward question by a teacher during remote schooling, she pretends to glitch. You know, she sits there and twitches. So I'm going to get mine over with.
Well, I might not be here when you're done, Emma. So I'm just saying.
Michael, that means you get the choice of weapon for how you'd like to be rudely cut down when we reach the 3 minutes. So would you like the school bell or the bicycle horn?
Well, to me, that's a clown horn, and I definitely want the clown horn.
You're going to get the clown horn, okay. So, Emma, it's over to you. I'm going to put 3 minutes on the clock. As I said, you don't have to use them all, but once you reach your three-minute mark, I'll be ringing you out with the school bell. Over to you, uninterrupted, to tell us about A Little Life.
A Little Life is, yes, ironically named. I think in my copy, this novel is 730 pages long. And all I can say is that several springs ago, it's now a couple of years since I read it, it was published in 2015 when it was shortlisted for the Man Booker, I found myself waking up early and getting out of bed to read this book. And although I'm an enthusiastic reader, I'm usually perfectly content to read a book once I'm already up for the day, or even later in the day. But this book, I would wake up and fret over the characters. And I emphasize fret because it's in no way an easy read, this book. Just as many people have tossed Moby Dick aside over the centuries, you know, I know many people who couldn't handle this book because it is so extreme in what it asks of you as a reader. But that's why I would make a case for it. A Little Life starts out in a way that might feel like it's going to be this enjoyable, leisurely read, the kind of book we've all read before, because it's about the friendship of four college friends who are now all living in Manhattan. An artist, an architect, an actor, and a lawyer. They're all men. One is biracial, one is black, one is white. We're not told about the other. And you think at first, oh yes, this will be a sort of, you know, well-observed and interesting social novel about four college friends. And you might think of, say, Donna Tartt. And then it takes on this weird direction because one of them, the lawyer, Jude, who's very brilliant and a great singer and makes great pastries and so on, he had not just a traumatic childhood, but the most appallingly traumatic upbringing. And the novel really starts to follow his story and in particular to look at how he is not recovering. He is not fixed. And I'm well aware, like many novelists, that, you know, fiction is so often consolatory. You know, we tell sad stories and then we show how the people get over them. But in this case, the novel is all about his lifelong damage. And I don't quite know how Hanya Yanahara managed to make this so compulsively interesting to me. But she cares so much about Jude, and he's surrounded by good friends. There's even an older couple in his life who sort of adopt him as an adult. There's kindness, there's love in his life, and yet nothing can ever quite fix him because he was so damaged. And you know, this isn't something I'd usually seek out, but she somehow makes me care so much about him and about his friends and about the painful paradox that they can't make up to him for all he's lost and for all he's suffered. And I found that the novel actually made me think about what fiction does and what's going on in our curiosity about these people. I sometimes felt guilty for caring this much and for wanting to know so much about what he went through, but I couldn't stop. It was absolutely compulsive reading, and I don't think I'll ever forget it.
Wow, fantastic. You brought that in with 7 seconds to spare, Emma, like a pro.
I had a timer on. There we go, there's my timer.
You shouldn't have admitted that. I have no sense of timing.
I would have gone on for hours otherwise.
Fabulous pitch, and what a book, and we'll come back and talk about that very shortly. But have a breather now, Emma, and Michael, you've got to step up to the plate here. So I'm putting 3 minutes back on our clock for you to tell us about Moby Dick.
Okay, well, let's be honest off the top here. I know you don't want to read this book. You don't. In fact, I didn't want to read the book before I read it, and there are lots of good reasons for that. Melville's story of the monomaniacal Captain Ahab leading a crew on a doomed expedition to exact revenge on the white whale that chewed off his leg on a previous voyage, for starters, Like a Little Life is a doorstopper. It's several hundred pages longer than more sensibly proportioned books, and Melville seems not to know or care what he's doing half the time. The book is complex and meandering. It's full of arcane allusions. There are multiple digressions that read more like essays on natural history than fiction. Early on in the book especially, characters are introduced that just disappear without explanation. And it's almost like Melville lost interest, or he just simply forgot that he mentioned them, which gives it a bit of a first draft feel in places. I mean, didn't the guy bother to reread his own damn book before he published it? And to top that off, the book is meant to be a celebration of what Melville refers to as the heroic whaling industry, and he does not spare us any details of the barbarity of the hunt. And yet, I'm eternally grateful to have been pressured into reading this magnificent, provoking, infuriating creation. The central characters and the central storyline are so elemental and elastic, they seem ready-made for any age, including our own. Ahab's all-consuming pursuit of the white whale can be read as an allegory for all sorts of modern ailments. For example, the appeal and rise of authoritarian leaders across the world at the moment, or the ways that a charismatic figure can infect otherwise rational people with their own grievances and prejudices, the destructive force of toxic masculinity, the futility of holding a grudge. And the book is an adventure story. It's chock full of amazing set pieces that manage to be harrowing, thrilling, hilarious. It's completely compelling when it isn't drifting off into barely related tangents. But the most overwhelming sense I was left with when I read this book was of the wonder and mystery of the natural world and its meditations on the transcendent marvels of the whale and of the ocean itself. They are among the most beautifully reverential and uplifting writing I have ever encountered. In fact, it reads like a nascent call to arms for the modern environmental movement. And that seems completely antithetical to the equally compelling descriptions that Melville gives us of the slaughtering and butchering of the whale hunt. And here, I think, in some way that I can't really articulate, is the genius of Moby Dick. It's that reverence and that barbarism sail hand in hand through the novel, as it does in the human heart. It's unlike anything written before or since. Read this book. I almost got in.
You went down fighting there.
I almost got in there.
I could see you were just bringing it home. A couple of seconds to go there. Oh, well done, Michael. You have a little breather. Emma, I want to talk about A Little Life because it's a book I have read. I read it for the Man Booker Prize when it was shortlisted. And everything you were saying there, I sort of agree with. And for those that haven't read it, I know that to get to look at a book that's 730 pages long and to be told it's pretty bleak doesn't necessarily make you want to read it. But you saying that you actually woke up early because you wanted to read this book is amazing to me because it makes me feel, God, how passionately you must have felt about it and about Jude and how amazing her storytelling is to have made you want to get up and just be with it again, you know?
Also, it's not consistently bleak. It's more like, you know, for instance, Jude has all sorts of talents. Lots of things come easily to him. He's got this sparkling set of friends. He's got lovely people in his life. So there are all these, you know, quite light and enjoyable and pleasure-filled moments. And then you get a flashback to one of the many horrifying things that happened in his childhood or, you know, a scene that reveals the ways in which he's, for instance, hurting himself still nowadays because he can't let his old pains go. So there's an astonishing contrast. You're kind of hurtled into the abyss and then pulled up again. And there's such a poignancy to the portrayal of friendship in the novel. You know, she's far more romantic about friendship than about romantic relationships. And she talks about friendship as this little miracle. And one of the most moving things I found was that as a reader, you're kind of caught up in the same dilemma as Jude's friends, that they really want to know what happened to him, and yet they know it's crass to ask, but they can't help but be curious and you know, desperate to know what happened to him. And so as a reader, I found myself thinking, oh, tell me more about what happened with that evil priest. And then I feel bad about that. And it made me realize the elements of voyeurism and almost taking pleasure in the pain of others that are part of the reading experience. So this book actually made me self-conscious about what's going on in me as a reader. So it comments on itself. It's not a sort of clever trick experience. You feel like you're one of Jude's friends, that you desperately care about him, but also maybe there's something suspect in how you want to know all the dreadful details.
Yeah, it really is. It's a wonderful novel. And Michael, I mean, your pitch was so brilliant because you instantly had me hooked by the fact that you started by saying, I know you don't want to read this book, and I didn't either. Because it is, you know, it is a doorstop. Again, we're talking about 730 odd pages for A Little Life. But, you know, this is a big old beast as well. this idea that it's got a first draft feel to it, meandering
It's
essays.
A bizarre creature.
You sort of speak so lovely, you know, after all that, you then say, well, actually, I feel really grateful to have read it.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think I've ever read a book where I've had so many contradictory responses, you know, to be so appalled and amazed and in awe and bored out of my mind and just completely unable to put the book down. It it just, there has never, I have never experienced a book where I've gone through that cycle over and over and over again. And it is, I mean, it's a singular thing. I reread some Virginia Woolf recently, and I was amazed by how contemporary it felt and how so much of what is being written now is doing the same things that Woolf did. And I think that's a testament to how incredibly good she was and how innovative she was. Whereas with a book like Moby Dick, there are no other Moby Dicks, and nobody's trying to write another Moby Dick because you can't do it. It is a singular thing, and warts and all, it was one of the most incredible reading experiences of my life.
Well, I am completely taken with both of your pictures. And having read Hanya Yanagihara's book, I know how wonderful it is. So I'm going to do something a little bit different here. I wouldn't usually do this, but because of the strength of both these books and the way you've put them forward, I'm going to award two first prizes. And the prize for the You Must Read book is going to go to A Little Life. And the prize for the best pitch is going to go to Moby Dick, okay? Because I think you did such an amazing job of making me really want to pick up that book now to find out what the hell is going on. And Emma, I think you did A Little Life very proud. And for anyone who hasn't read that, I would also wholeheartedly recommend it. So both absolutely brilliant guys. And I think that's the fair outcome.
They should do that with the Booker.
Yes, maybe they should, yeah. I'll suggest it to them for this year. The Pull of the Stars by Emma Donoghue is published by Picador. It's out now, as is The Innocents by Michael Crummy, which is published by No Exit Press. And they're both really, really great reads with beautiful front covers. Never judge a book by its cover, but in this case, you can. So we suggest finding a space on your bookshelves so that you can slot these two books in. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you enjoyed our latest episode. If you're listening via iTunes or Apple Podcasts on your iPhone, do take a moment to rate and review our podcast. It's really quick, very easy, and it's hugely appreciated. And if you're new to us or a new listener, do follow us on the social medias. We are at @odobookoff, and do say hello. Emma, Michael, what an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast and to be connected across the ocean and spend some time with you. Thank you both for your recommendations, and thanks very much for telling us about your latest books.
It's been lovely. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.